Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Judge Nancy Gertner, a 1971 graduate and visiting lecturer at Yale Law School, discusses the career choices she made on the path to becoming a federal judge.
I wanted to start in two ways. One is a silly way and one is a serious way. The serious way is derives from a memorial service that I attended last week for Katie Rohrbeck. Katie Rohrbeck was a graduate of this school and was the only woman criminal defense lawyer that I had ever known when I was here in 1971. To say she was a role model doesn't begin to address. I didn't think it was possible for someone with a high voice and this, you know, configuration of organs to be a criminal defense lawyer, much less a litigator. And Katie, I spoke at her memorial service because she handed me a career. It was more than just mentoring. She handed me a career. In three years into my practice, criminal practice, I was asked to represent a woman who was accused of murder and murdering a police officer and robbing a bank partly for the Vietnam War, to raise money to oppose the Vietnam War. It was that era's O.J. Simpson case, and I'll talk a little bit about it. But I was a lawyer for 3 years. I had never done a murder case. When she asked me how many criminal trials I had, I rounded off 3 to the nearest 10. She wanted a woman lawyer to represent her. She was a feminist. And aside from Katie, I was the only one. Katie was going to represent her in Philadelphia. She was facing armed robbery charges in Philadelphia and murder and armed robbery charges in Boston. Katie was going to represent her in Philadelphia. She asked me to help on minor issues. It was perfect for a baby lawyer because that's all I could handle was minor issues. And then Katie decided she didn't want to do the Philadelphia case anymore. After she finished the Philadelphia case, she didn't want to do the Massachusetts case because she didn't want to travel. And she told Susan that she should choose me to represent her. It was extraordinary. I had only this degree, which I'll tell you in a moment what that was worth. And I had my passion, and that was it. I was in a small partnership at that point, civil rights practice with 3 other people, and they said, you can't do it. I wasn't a partner. They said, you can't take this case. You can't take this case. It'll completely decimate the firm. So I drove out to where Katie then was staying, which was in Canaan, Connecticut, and I talked to her about how one makes choices in one's life. How do you choose? Should I take this case, even though it would have meant, just devastating in terms of money? Should I walk away from my firm? Tell them, you don't want me to do it? Well, that's fine. I'm going to do it myself. How could I possibly do a case that was a murder case by myself? And we talked for a long time by the side of the lake. And I said all this last week, and she said to me, you ultimately have to do what you love. You ultimately have to do what makes you passionate, and then everything else will follow. So I went back to Boston. I told my partners, I'm going to do this case, and you'll either be with me or without me. Thankfully, they joined me. But her words, in fact, shaped the kinds of choices I made as a lawyer over the next 23 years. And the sort of funny version of that took place here it was about 13 years ago. I was on a panel with Sonia Sotomayor, who's a judge of the Second Circuit. And it was before women, and the women wanted to know, how do you learn to be a judge? What kinds of choices do you make, Judge Gertner and Judge Sotomayor, to become a judge? Just tell us that, and we'll sort of follow it. I said, well, first, you represent a lesbian, feminist, radical revolutionary accused of killing a cop. You take every abortion case in the state of Massachusetts, every gay case involving gay rights, every prison case, and there you have it. Interestingly enough, Judge Sotomayor, of course, had tried to work out how she would become a judge, and in fact had been very cautious in her career. She and I were both stereotyped in the same way. In other words, it didn't matter what she had done, it didn't matter what I had done. She was being caricatured as a Puerto Rican judge, feminist, even though that really wasn't the direction her life had taken. It didn't matter. So the message I tried to communicate was that you have to do what you love. You have to do what you care about. Otherwise, when you tally up the figures at the end of your life, you're not sure where you're going to be. You're not sure where you're going to be at all. And I also, for me, perhaps it was a particularly easy story to tell because I had been born. For me, it was an extraordinary journey even to get to this school. I was born on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. My parents were very poor. I slept in a crib until I was 7 because they couldn't afford a bed. They finally moved to Flushing, Queens, which was they thought was suburbia, but in fact it's in the flight path of LaGuardia Airport. It's hardly suburbia. And they never quite shook. And I was raised in very modest circumstances. They never quite shook that. And in fact, after I graduated Yale, I was on my way to a fancy clerkship. I had done fabulously here. My mother and I had a fight, the kind of fight that only mothers and daughters can have. The women in the room would understand this. You say things you will never, ever want to say to anyone in life. We were screaming at one another. What were we fighting about? She wanted me to take the Triborough Bridge toll takers test just in case. You never know, right? And in fact, I told that story when I was sworn in as a judge. You know, Breyer was on the stage because I wanted to make it clear that I knew how to put this in context. And in fact, in the middle of the service, I looked up and I said, excuse me, I have to say a word to my mother. Ma, a government job. Right? So it's been a long trajectory here, and I could never have planned any of it. So let me start at the beginning. The story begins next door. And what, you know, all of you have plans about what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, of course, I mean, I was either going to be an actress, and some say I still am. In fact, I also wanted to be president of the United States. But I sort of clocked this out that you first had to become a lawyer, then a senator, and then run for president. The reason I thought about this conversation is that I remember, I don't know how many years ago, sitting next door in the Coke Lounge with another woman in my class at Yale, dreaming about where we were going to be in our lives, talking about relationships and food and diets and politics and careers. And of course, it was Hillary Clinton, who was the year behind me and with whom I was very close. She looks like she might make it. I got a little stalled. You know, just took a little curve. But who would have thought that any of our lives, in one sense, even her lives, would have taken the turns they did. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this very improbable career as a lawyer. In one sense, an improbable career as a judge. And the next phase, which looks to be something like international human rights. And the phase after that, I haven't clocked out, but we're working on it. So when I left Yale, I thought I wanted to teach. I've always loved teaching. I always loved academics. It's always been interwoven throughout everything that I did. But I thought I had a PhD. I had a MA in political science. I was actually going to get a PhD. I found a letter to Stan Wheeler in which I floated a proposal. He didn't like it at all. But I was going to be an academic, and I was only going to practice for 2 years. And then I was going to go and be in a library. You know, I was going to go and be an academic. And then the Sachs case came, this very out-of-the-blue kind of case. And again, it was the O.J. Simpson case of the epoch. Publicity was everywhere, and I was a nobody. The day before the trial began, the Boston Globe headline reads, Sachs case to begin tomorrow, prosecutor able, comma, tough. Where was I in this? I was a complete nobody. And as I said, Susan Sachs selected me because she figured it was a hopeless case. She was going to spend the rest of her life in jail, and she wanted the symbolism of a woman lawyer. And when Katie couldn't do it, there was like only two of us, and so it had to have been me. Let me tell you a little bit about that case, just to let you know how even really improbable this is. In fact, I have the beginning of my book, which is another story, goes like this. When I was 29 and she was 25, I defended Susan Sachs, an anti-Vietnam War activist accused of robbery and murder. The judge kept on calling me Susan Gertner. Even Susan's mother, Rose, confused me with her daughter. The prosecutor assumed that since Susan was gay, I was gay. And that rumor lasted 20 years, a husband and three children later, when I was nominated to be a federal judge. I identified with my clients deeply, and Susan more so, but I was the lawyer, not the client. Empathy was a given. Detachment was what I had to learn. The case comes into the office, and the way it worked was this. Five individuals had robbed the State Street Bank and Trust Company. One man was guarding the exit in one car. Three were in the bank. One person was guarding the getaway. Susan was one of the three in the bank. The three in the bank rob the bank, leave, get in the car with the woman in the getaway car. But the man in the front didn't realize they had left. And when the officer, who was a highly decorated officer, walked up the front of the building, he assumed they were still inside, and Gilday was his name, shot him in the back. The officer died. It was a horror story. The men were caught immediately, and they were immediately convicted. In fact, one got the death penalty, although that was subsequently set aside. Susan and Kathy went on the lam for the next, in Susan's case, 5 years, in Kathy's case, 20 years. There were so many ironies about this story, the FBI didn't know where to find them because they were looking in bars. They needed to look in health food stores and daycare centers. The women were part of a feminist underground that was sort of beginning at the time, and the FBI didn't have any idea how to do that. In any event, in 1975, Susan is caught, and I told you some of the history about how I got the case. Everyone in town who knew me, and there weren't very many, and particularly older male lawyers who occasionally appear in front of me now, would put their arms around me and say, "Sweetie, you are in way over your head, way over your head." And I remember all of them. I've written their names down. They're in a folder called Sexist Tidbits, which I've kept to this day. Really, that's another story. And everyone assumed that the case would be immediate conviction. To make a long story short, there was virtually no case against Susan Sachs, but no one knew that. There was no pictures of her in the bank. There was no physical evidence. It was completely the testimony of a cooperating witness. And as the case went on, the press began to move a little bit about, well, you know, this is actually very interesting. We knew that the government had devastating evidence which they had not yet produced. Susan had written to her father and to a rabbi saying, "When you get this letter, you know what your baby has been doing." We knew they had those letters. And we knew that that, of course, would be the end of the case. They held the letters. And as the days wore on during the government's case, the government completely underestimated me and assumed that we were going to try the Vietnam War. There was no way in hell we would try the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War would never justify killing and bank robbery. In fact, we had absolutely no defense. I had absolutely no idea what we were going to do the minute the government rested. We had various alternatives, but we had no idea. You had to try the case because it was a first-degree murder case, but I had no idea what we were going to do. So the government goes along and finally announces that they're about to rest without putting these letters in, fully expecting us to try. Daniel Berrigan was in the hallway. You know, we let this build and build. Every anti-war icon was outside. And so the government rested, figuring that we would put on this ridiculous case, and then they would pull out these two letters. And when we thought that was happening, I prepared a closing argument, my fifth or sixth. And the day that the government said, "I rest," I got up, and in a voice that shattered glass, which is what happened when I got nervous, I said, "In that case, we rest too." And we rested. I get a closing argument that day, which of course I had well prepared for. The government had not, although they had done it so many times before. The first day, the newspapers say that the jury is 9-3 for acquittal. 9-3 for acquittal. The next day, it's 10-2 for acquittal. And by the end of the week, it was 11-1 for acquittal. And everyone in town knew that. The jury hung at 11-1. But I went from being a who is she again to suddenly having anything I wanted in terms of a career. Not money, to be sure, but any case I wanted. Any criminal case, any discrimination case, any civil rights case. So the academic career sort of took a back burner because suddenly I could directly implement what had been in the air in Yale all those years. You know, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, I could take all of those cases. And in fact, I did. We took every abortion case in Massachusetts. I was involved in the school case, the school desegregation case. I was involved in deinstitutionalization. I found the file the other day from the Coalition to Stop Institutional Violence, which were trying to get people out of Bridgewater State Mental Hospital. People would come into my office, and if it sounded interesting, I would, and I could make a difference, I would say yes. And so there was 1,400 clamshell demonstrators, the Clamshell Alliance against the nuclear power plant in Seabrook. Criminal cases move from clearly I couldn't make a living at all if my criminal law specialty was lesbian, feminist, radical, revolutionary. I clearly had to broaden the criminal practice, and I did, representing people whom I thought needed representation. It would include one day reading the paper about a woman who was gay who had been sentenced to life imprisonment, with the judge saying, she'd been involved in a violent act, and the judge said, you don't belong in the animal kingdom. And this was quoted in the paper. So the next day, I went to where she was being sentenced, and after it was finished, after the sentencing, rather, I went and visited her, and I asked her if I could represent her for free. I went in the next day to enter my appearance in the court. The judge said, you can't enter an appearance. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm not seeking an appointment. I am just entering my appearance free. Judge says, I'm sorry, you can't do that. So I sued the judge. Gertner versus Chmielewski, I think you'll find it. And because he had no right to prevent anyone from doing as crazy a thing as I was planning to do. But it was essentially, there was an incredible power that came to all of this, because it was the power to say, to act in improbable ways, which is to litigate without a view to some degree, how it looked, because I thought it with my first case, any future career was largely over. You could litigate without a regard to money to some degree, because I didn't really care about that. And what did I learn from these days? Well, one is what it feels like to save someone's life. I mean, that was the lesson of the Sachs case. When Susan was finally, she ultimately pled guilty to a lesser charge, did about 8 years, and got out of jail. And on the day that her last parole ran out, she called me at midnight and said, you saved my life. I didn't anticipate lawyering would involve saving people's lives. So I learned what it felt like to do that. I also learned what it felt like to pour yourself into something and win. That reinforces the desire to pour yourself into things because you anticipate the next time that there would be winning. I also could not get off the feeling of being passionate about the work. It was so wonderful to be passionate about the work, and it was clear that success in part followed that kind of passion. And I also learned, although this was not an easy lesson, it was in one sense a version of being an actress and being a politician. I love to talk to people and juries and students, and the communication issue was all part of the same piece. So that career went on for 23 years, and I think it's fair to say that I rang every bell. All during this period of time, I also taught, because there were periods of time that was the only money coming in, teaching, but the teaching was also something that had never quite left me. I never saw the difference between the huge chasm that people talk about between academia and practice. In part, when I was doing discrimination cases, sex discrimination cases, we were inventing the field. So I would teach about it because we were making it up as we went along. And what the students would talk about in class would then be what we would use in our court, and of course, in cases, and of course, I still do that. Full stop here for a moment. You are all thinking to yourself, how'd you earn a living? How'd you pay back your loans? What about a family, right? How do you live this kind of screwball life and a family? And the sort of subtext of this, how did I deal with discrimination? Because for the women in the room and for the minorities in the room, don't take my success as an indication that anything is secure. So let me start with the money. I didn't have the kind of loans that you had, not because I could afford to pay for law school, but because law school didn't cost as much. It was as simple as that. And I simply wanted to do what I wanted to do. The firm was a small firm in Boston. The first office was over a fish factory. From time to time, it was pretty horrible in the fish factory, but there was no, the overhead was low. We began to move up a little bit as we began to make money, and in short order, I did begin to make money. The criminal cases came in and began to be lucrative. The discrimination cases began to be lucrative, and I became sort of a well-known litigator, and so I could, in fact, make money. Money like people make in the firms? No. But it was fine. Family, the abortion cases brought together two litigators, me and this person that I fell in love with, who was, we did these cases together. Of course, that was the only way it would happen because I was such a crazy maniac workaholic that I was, the only person that was gonna get close was someone that was staying up all night with me, right, to do the brief. One thing led to another in any event. I married when I was 39. Menopause and birth were neck and neck. John had a daughter. I had two sons in short order, one went when I was 39, one when I was 41. They, at that point, doing it in that order was in one sense terrific because I already had a career and had made my name and had people who could help me with the work. And I married someone who, when we were working on the abortion cases together, would push me in front of the cameras. Who, when we walked into court, would say, "This is a woman's issue. You ought to do the argument." Of course, he regretted that, has regretted it ever since, because I don't think he's ever gotten a word in edgewise since then. But I was astonished, and that's how we started. The discrimination issue never leaves my mind. The first 3 years before the Sachs case, I have all the stories that some of the women on these walls could tell you about judges who would say to me when I came in with a young woman student, "Judge, can she sit with me?" He said, "Geez, I thought one woman in a courtroom was bad enough." People you'd be litigating with in cases who would write to my male partner when I would send the letter. And so we had a stock response, which is when, I'll start talking to you when you get out of the 19th century. So we had, and I had a whole stock of funny responses as well to deal with funny and sarcastic responses to deal with the kind of comments that we got. You won't get, but you'll get a version of it. You won't get it as directly because people know better, but you'll certainly get the sense of, can you really do this? Can you, for whatever set of stereotypes there are. So the discrimination issue to some degree was met by the status that I garnered by being a litigator. How did I come to this position then? Fast forward, 14 chapters in my book, I'll tell you about the book later, 14 chapters in my book, I wind up, Hillary calls me. We had been friends all these years. We parted company, I'd like to say a little bit, because I didn't approve of her husband. But, but you know, there was a reason for that. It wasn't just in general. I mean, when we graduated law school, everybody was trying to come to a place where where they and their husband or wife could both work. I know some of you have spent some time doing that here. And here he was telling her to go to Arkansas, which was, what, 10 or 15 years away from Orville Faubus. And, you know, I thought that it was crazy that she would be going there to be with him. It was not a decision I was going to make, and it was certainly not a decision I made. In any event, when they were running for office, listen to me, I helped. And when he won, I was in the middle of a particularly difficult, high-profile criminal case. And literally on the day of the Clinton election, I pled. This guy's name was Matthew Stewart. Any of you from Boston know he was the brother of the man who killed his pregnant wife. It's a long story. But as soon as he pled, I got on a plane to Arkansas to celebrate Bill Clinton's victory. I threw my name in the ring for judge, thinking that that it was impossible. I was told to collect all of my stories to see if there's anything that would embarrass the president. I determined that everything I had ever done in my life would embarrass the president. And actually, the book that I wrote and hasn't been published is part of those kinds of stories. I thought I had no chance. I thought it would be something I would talk about to my kids about this process. What I didn't count on was Ted Kennedy. Not Bill and Hillary, actually, but Ted Kennedy. And Ted Kennedy had four vacancies on the federal court, the District of Massachusetts, and he had someone for every one of them. It was a friend of Clinton, a very good woman lawyer who's also a Kennedy staffer, wonderful African-American judge, a guy from Western Massachusetts. And Kennedy interviews me, again, and when you think that you don't have a prayer, you are fabulous, right? You are absolutely fabulous. So I was funny and relaxed. It was one of the most inappropriate conversations between a potential judge and the senator. I was just a hoot, and because I thought, this is going to be fun. And then I get up to leave, and everybody's standing around, and I say, Senator, I have a bone to pick with you. And at this point, all the staffers who were actually trying to get me recommended looked like they were about to die. And so I said to him, Senator, just once, pick someone with a civil rights career to be a judge. Reward this kind, doesn't have to be me, but reward this kind of career with a judgeship. I understand that Kennedy then persuaded one of the judges who had not yet taken senior status, Dave Mazzone, to take senior status so there could be a vacancy, and so that I could go for the fifth seat. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy to get confirmed, and at any point I surely would have walked away. I surely would have walked away, except for his commitment. I've told this story to some of you already because it's my favorite story, and it says something about how the discrimination stereotypes go through a resurgence periodically in your life. A week before my hearing before the Judiciary Committee, a Herald columnist, Boston Herald columnist, who did not know me from Adam, writes a column comparing me to Lorena Bobbitt. Judge Gertner would do to justice with her gavel what Lorena did to her husband with a kitchen knife. Right? All of this career, all of this work, all of this principle sort of dissolved into a caricature. The caricature worked. The Jesse Helms objected to my nomination and drove off, and I was held, everyone else was confirmed, I was held up for 9 or 10 months. I've just heard that I ran into Sissy Daughtry, who is a wonderful Sixth Circuit judge, and she remembers my name starting to appear on a hit list by the 9th or 10th month, you know, Stop, Barquette, Daughtry, and Gertner. The Republicans had actually not yet mobilized against the district court. One morning at breakfast, my husband looks at the headlines and says, you'll never believe this. Kennedy votes for a Helms school prayer amendment. I call the senator and I say to him, I'm not worth this. He says, don't worry, we'll take care of it in committee. And then he says, trying to mimic a Southern accent, which was one of the funniest conversations, he said, I've talked to Jesse, and he said, Senator, you got your judge. And I was confirmed. The story doesn't end then, but I want to move on. I can't say that it was easy at the beginning. Not the work. The work was not difficult. I had been a trial lawyer, an appellate lawyer, state and federal, Supreme Court, every level, and taught at Harvard in the middle of this. So the work wasn't hard. It was trying to figure out how to be me in the job that was hard. Clarence Thomas, when he became a judge, described his confirmation process as stripping down like a runner, right, with no entangling opinions. Well, I'd been practicing for 23 years. I couldn't possibly say that. But ultimately, I began to be comfortable in the job because I realized that I knew exactly what I believed. And I knew exactly where my beliefs ended and the work began. There was no ambiguity about it. I knew when my beliefs could not remotely influence the outcome. I knew when my beliefs, in fact, when I could actually do something. And when I couldn't do something in a case that I thought was fair, I had, and again, some people from my class know this, I had what I described as an oy footnote. First Circuit requires me to do X. The Supreme Court requires me to do X. And so I'll do X. Footnote. Oy, is this ridiculous? Some decisions were all oy, particularly in recent years. It's also the case that the politics, I think it was Frank Rich this weekend who described it as the new normal. Politics has moved so far that my court, which is composed of judges from all, from Carter appointees, Reagan appointees, Bush appointees, we are all aghast at what we see. So in one sense, harmonizing who I am in this job is less and less difficult. My book ends with a chapter that says, you are a what? Because that's where I had finished writing it. And when I was sort of particularly defensive at somehow how someone like me could be a judge, I'm no longer defensive. The next version of it is going to talk about how important it is to bring these sensibilities to the bench. And I'm not talking about activist lawyers or judge sensibilities. I'm talking about people who know people, who have lived, who have engaged with human beings. In fact, Dean wrote to me at the end of the summer when there was an article about someone I had sentenced who was shot. And the article was about how I had sentenced this kid. The sentencing guidelines were off the chart. I had done what I could to get his sentence to a level that I thought was sustainable. After he got out of jail, he, instead of going to probation, he went into my courtroom and we met and we talked. And I bonded with him, and as I have with others. And the day that he was shot, I was a very difficult day. And the article was all about how unusual it was that a judge would have this kind of relationship with a defendant. It is not so unusual. Empathy was a given, as I said at the beginning of this book. Detachment was what I had to learn. One is more detached as a judge, but to some degree, I come at the job not regarding it as an abstraction. What I bring to the job, as people in my class know this, an acute anti-formalism, acute sense of how discrimination law, using one example, has sort of dissolved into taking a complex human phenomenon and making it in a series of disaggregated abstractions. Criminal law has gone in the other direction, which is everything is a balancing test, everything is cumulative, everything is harmless error. And I, having both an academic and a practical perspective, have a sense of what's right and what's wrong about the law. I had trouble as a judge in sentencing initially because It's one thing to argue for someone's liberty. It's quite another thing to free that person or to incarcerate that person. And I came back to Yale after all these years because I was invited by Dan Freed to be a participant in the sentencing class here. And what I found was that you all were far more interesting and far more sophisticated than any of the people, judges, lawyers, even other academics that I was running into. And so when Dan asked me to co-teach the class, I said, I'm coming back and co-teach the class. And now there's also a wonderful sort of seed that has been sown. Many of the people from my class over the years have clerked for other judges. And now I get calls from people saying, tell me who's in your class. I'm interested. And I have a sense that there are, you know, the sentencing seminar has just spread out across the United States, which is a good thing. But the seminar looks at issues abstractly and concretely. We sentence individuals, and we also talk about the principles. And I take from what I have learned in class without attribution and put it in my decisions. The next step, so I love what I do now. I have figured out, it's like the princess and the pea. There's nothing wrong with trying to find where justice is at the bottom of the mattress. You may not be able to get there in every case. It may be that 1,000 rules have intervened over the years, but I will certainly try to understand what the just result is, and that comes from this career. The international stuff, in one sense, is it enables me to be who I was, because the issues are so much more stark. When you go to Liberia, you're talking about rights at a sort of fundamental level. 70% of the women have been raped. Dealing with these issues is dealing with sort of fundamental, basic kinds of issues. So I do plan to do more of that. And who knows where this will lead me. It will not be the Supreme Court. I just want to make this perfectly clear. My husband, when I was became a judge, said to me that the advantage of you becoming a judge is it'll clean up your resume. It has not. It has not. One final note about Yale. How did Yale prepare me for any of this? Well, let me tell you the way it did not prepare me. When I took the bar exam in Massachusetts, when I took the bar exam in Massachusetts, I thought dying intestate was a disease. Right. You know, it's prostate, intestate, it seems to follow, right? I can't tell you what I thought bulk transfers were, but I can go there. But I had taken sociology of law 1 through 10 here. So I had taken Spanish for law school credit, and we went on strike in the middle of the year. So the only Spanish I know how to say is, the police attacked the students. I don't know how to say, where's the bathroom? You know? But what I learned was social justice and passion and analysis and to be critical of the things that you see. And in one sense, the beginning of combining practice and academics in an interesting way. My second year at Yale, I worked for Mobilization for Youth and the Columbia Center for Social Welfare Policy and Law, and a firm to pay for everything. A woman walked in who was a welfare recipient who didn't want the social worker to come into her house. Social workers were coming into the house to see if there was a man in the house, and she could be prosecuted criminally for it. That wasn't the only purpose, but that was one purpose. And she decided that she didn't want the social worker to come in without her permission or without a warrant. And so the Mobilization for Youth litigated a case called Wyman v. James, which was a case dealing with whether or not if the social worker is acting looking for evidence of a crime, the model, the paradigm that should apply is the criminal paradigm and not sort of therapeutic paradigm. The following year was the first year of the law school competition, writing competition. And I wrote a law review article on Wyman v. James, which I had become completely enmeshed in. It was not an advocacy piece. It was analyzing the paradigms of the criminal law model, the therapeutic model, and analyzing the case. The case was then cited by the Supreme Court in the decision. Unfortunately, on the wrong side, the case lost. And now the only people citing this particular decision, this particular article, is me. If you do a site check of rehabilitation, investigation, and the welfare home visit, I didn't catchy title this wasn't, you'll find that it has been cited regularly in my decisions, which is really one way to gin up the citation index. But what it was about was there was a real person that I had met. There was a very important issue that I had become engaged in. I wrote about the issue. I participated in the case. And it was that really became a model for the rest of my life. The writing that I do is really part of what I regard as judging and thinking and part of the enterprise. So my kids have not become axe murderers, not yet. We've made a decent living, not as good as we would like. And in terms of the discrimination issue, I still have that file, and I know where you are. So why don't we stop for questions? Thank you.